Is there a monopoly in electronic books?
A new investigation is underway.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, August 3rd. Today, Connecticut's Attorney General announced an investigation into possible anti-competitive pricing of e-books.
A study out today suggests foreign doctors might be better doctors. And what's the greatest thing since sliced bread? Well, the answer has to do with your omega-3 levels. But first,
Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal said today he is looking into possible anti-competitive pricing of e-books by Amazon and Apple. Here to scroll through the story with us is Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Hi, Mitchell.
Good morning, Bill.
So whether there's a monopoly or not, aren't e-books relatively cheap?
Well, yeah, compared to a lot of new hardcovers, they're a bargain, mostly under $15 at the big online retail sites like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. But they're more expensive than they used to be. When this e-reader technology was just coming out and no one knew if people would want to read a book on a screen, most e-books were priced lower, under $10. Then a few months ago, conveniently, this was just before Apple launched its new iPad, five big publishers made a deal with Apple and Amazon. That resulted in higher ebook prices, and the publishers are guaranteed a bigger cut of the sales.
Mm-hmm. And is that what might cross the antitrust laws?
Well, a number of government antitrust busters seem to think so. Connecticut and also Texas are investigating. So are the Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department. Now, in their defense, the publishers say that if prices are any lower, they'll actually lose money publishing ebooks, and fewer new titles would then come out. On the other hand, you know, ebook sales are booming. Amazon's now selling more ebooks than hardcovers. E-readers are flying off the shelves. All that looks to the antitrust folks like a pretty healthy market, and it suggests that the publishers don't need these deals to keep prices high and to keep growing their business.
Okay, I'm logging you off now. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
The U.S. government says it is disappointed by the move to ban BlackBerry's internet services in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. The ban will apply to business travelers and tourists as well. The BBC's Mark Gregory reports other countries also have some security concerns about the BlackBerry.
The United Arab Emirates says it needs to view BlackBerry's wireless data to improve security and fight terrorism. The government insists it's only asking for the same concessions as BlackBerry already gives the US and other countries. Marek Pawłowski keeps tabs on the mobile phone industry for Mex Consulting. He says BlackBerry maker Research in Motion, or RIM, is used to these types of threats.
It's worth remembering that RIM is not particularly new to these problems because of the way in which it structures its service. It has faced these kind of concerns before, and yet still the business has continued to grow.
Whatever deal RIM makes with foreign governments is unlikely ever to be known in full. And despite its statements about the UAE, analysts say the US government can probably read things on your BlackBerry even it won't admit to. In London, I'm the BBC's Mark Gregory for Marketplace.
Comcast Cable has signed a deal with CBS Television to continue providing programming for the next 10 years. As part of the deal, the cable giant will be able to expand its on-demand access to the company's shows. And the agreement covers CBS Television, Showtime Networks, and the CBS College Sports Channel. Brad Adgate is Senior Vice President of Research with Horizon Media. He's with us from New York. Good morning, Brad.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
All right. So it's odd that we're hearing about a 10-year deal. That's a long time. Why'd they go that long?
Well, I think part of it is just to Comcast is under the, being looked at the FCC. They want to acquire NBC, a big rival of CBS. And I think there's some concerns about how big can Comcast do it. And I think this is a way to show the FCC and competitors that they're willing to play ball.
They're willing to play ball. And you mentioned the Comcast acquisition of NBC. Were there any implications alongside that?
I think so. I think, you know, they're getting some concerns about how big is big. It's a huge deal, and certainly it involves a lot of, you know, stations and the network and studios and cable networks. And, you know, these go head-to-head with CBS. So it's not like, you know, they're going to be the 800-pound, you know, mammoth that's going to control the marketplace. They're going to negotiate with their competitors.
And what do they stand to gain from CBS?
Well, I think, you know, the gain they stand to gain from CBS is it's the most watched network. They have a lot of premier sporting events, including the Super Bowl and March Madness. And I think that CBS, you know, CBS gets some sort of 10-year commitment. They get, you know, some sort of 23 million subscribers. So they gain from that as well. And also, CBS is almost exclusively dependent on ad revenue. So this kind of gives them a second revenue stream that will enable them to just, you know, soften the blow when the economy goes slow.
Very quickly, Brad, I know ABC and Time Warner are in the depths of negotiations as well. Are we going to see something similar there?
I think so. I think the marketplace has been set. You know, Comcast is 23 million subs. CBS is the largest network. I think that this is the bar, and I think that I'd be very surprised if the ABC Time Warner, even though it's in the 11th hour, won't come to some sort of agreement.
Brad Adgate with Horizon Media in New York. Brad, thanks.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, August 3rd. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. No sign of economic recovery in a government report this morning. Americans' personal income and spending were both flat in June. Let's bring in analyst Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company. She joins us every Tuesday from St. Louis. Hi.
Morning, Bill.
So the government told us this morning Americans didn't make any more money in June. That was flat. We didn't spend any more. Basically, we saved our money. Is that because we're socking it away for what we all think is going to be a rainy day?
Well, we're finally becoming prudent. The consumer is paying down debt because our total debt level is still staggering, even at the consumer level. There's high uncertainty on jobs. The job market really isn't hemorrhaging anymore. We're not losing a lot of them, but we're not finding new jobs. So there's that high degree of uncertainty as well. And consumers are out there buying what they need, not necessarily what they want yet. So this is a new prudency, and it's keeping us flat.
Well, you say people are buying what they need, not what they want. But let's look at one purchase, Julie. I'm trying to figure this out. U.S. automakers will report their July sales today. Car sales have been up the last few months, and the experts say that news is probably going to continue today. So given what we just talked about, how is that possible?
Well, part of that demand is coming from China. There's very strong demand there. And there's rise in the United States. It's due to high-end sales. And that reflects our recovery. Big business, big banks, and big income earners are all recovering quite nicely, thank you. Everybody else, though, when you're trying to deal at the lower end, there's 0% financing. They're trying to move the metal any way that they can. Toyota, in fact, is coming in cheaper leasing than you can even buy, and that's going to come back to haunt them. But BMW, Audi, they're all doing very well. That's where the big auto sales are coming from.
Julie, since we have a few extra seconds here, can I ask you about a report I heard that maybe Americans are buying cars instead of homes?
Some Americans have decided that since they're inverted on their mortgages, they're going to not pay the mortgages, instead use that money to buy toys, games, and prizes, and they're out there buying luxury items. So less than a contractual agreement here. This is a new way to scam the banks here, in my opinion.
Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Now, those are all signs that the economy is fluttering, figuring out which way it wants to go. A new report says the Fed is looking at a few options to help. One idea that's gained a little traction is pouring more money into new mortgage bonds as old ones the Fed had bought begin to mature. Reporter John Hilsenrath is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he wrote the article this morning. He's with us from Washington. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So the Fed initially said it was going to let the money it had invested in these mortgage bonds shrink, the amount of money, right? Why the change of heart?
Well, some of the data has looked pretty soft. So they were going to let these mortgage bonds roll off. Now they're thinking, all right, you know what? Maybe we should just keep reinvesting what we've got to keep the money that we have in the economy still there, trying to do the work that it does.
Keep the investment going. So what else is on the table, John?
they can use their language, the bully pulpit, so to speak, to explain to investors and the public that interest rates, which are already near zero, are going to stay there for a really long time. The hope would be that that would encourage more risk-taking by business, by households, with the understanding that interest rates are going to stay low for a while.
Hey, John, how exactly do any of these plans help the economy? I mean, pumping more money into bonds or treasuries, what does that mean to the guy who doesn't have a job?
Well, you know, you're asking the question that Ben Bernanke is asking right now. And, you know, the problem is everything that they're doing is unconventional at this point. So they're not sure how it helps the economy. You know, they have their theories about how it does. The idea is it helps to keep interest rates low, which, you know, which provokes more borrowing, you know, more investment by business, which could create jobs. But these are very unconventional tools, and they're very uncertain about how well they'll work.
John Hilzenrath, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, we thank you for your time.
Okay.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, August 3rd. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and in economics around the world, and how it affects us right here in the United States. Just a couple of years ago, food prices soared to new highs, rising demand, declining stockpiles, and some say speculators helped drive those prices up. Now a scorching heat wave in Russia may be sending food prices skyward again. Christopher Wirth has more.
Russian and Ukrainian wheat farms make up one of the biggest breadbaskets in the world. But with temperatures in Moscow reaching 100 degrees, crops have withered. A loss in wheat supply has sent prices soaring roughly 50% since the end of June, the highest since 2008, when the food crisis sparked off riots around the world. Michael Seary is with Olympus Futures in Chicago. He says with crops also affected by weather and pests in places such as Canada and Australia, prices could go higher.
The thing with the futures market, it's pricing in basically all doom and gloom here. You know, wheat definitely can go higher. It's still almost half of what it was a couple of years ago. And we had terrific droughts there. Different parts of the world had the droughts, and that skyrocketed very, very quickly.
And remember, wheat is used to feed livestock and make all sorts of other things. So higher wheat prices could cascade through the supermarket, raising the price on everything from beef to beer. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth. For Marketplace.
The U.S. has a visa program that encourages illegal immigrants who've been victims of a crime to report that crime and serve as witnesses. Well, this year there were so many snitches, the Immigration Service used up all 10,000 visa slots. Reporter Jill Barchet has more.
Illegal immigrants who've suffered abuse or injury in a major crime, such as rape or attempted murder, can earn a U visa. It grants working papers to the victim so long as he or she cooperates with police and prosecutors. Alejandro Mayorkas is the director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. He says he has anecdotal evidence that U visas are helping to get illegals to report more crimes.
By being able to provide them with the assurance that they will be safe, that they will have the support of the government as they come forward and assist the government in apprehending criminals, we are able to put those cases together.
Immigration attorney Laura Lichter says it's tough to get a police officer to certify that an illegal was helpful.
Anyone who says this is easy or people are fraudulently reporting crimes or somebody hit the jackpot because they were the victim of a domestic assault really is having it wrong.
If the visa application is denied, the undocumented resident can be deported. I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
A quarter of all doctors in America, one in four, graduated from medical schools abroad. Now, that's a good thing, according to a new study. Research published today in the journal Health Affairs says that foreign diploma could mean a better doctor. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
If you got your medical degree overseas, don't bother applying for a residency in most hospitals.
They wouldn't even consider them to have an interview for a position.
Dr. Ian Krantz is a professor at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and chairman of a commission that certifies foreign medical graduates. He says those students suffer under a stigma that their education is second rate. They end up taking the jobs that graduates of American schools tend to avoid, at hospitals in rural towns and inner cities. Krantz studied 6,000 doctors and their performance measures. He found that foreigners with international diplomas did just as well, or even better, than their U.S.-educated counterparts. Not so for Americans that studied abroad. John Norsini, the study's lead author, says those doctors had the worst performance rankings.
It may be that they're not quite as qualified to begin with.
Which could mean if you see a foreign diploma on your doctor's wall, you should hope he or she's got a foreign accent, too. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Steve Chiatakis. They're not necessarily companions for better nutrition, but tequila and cheese can teach us a lot about boosting economies in the developing world. A recent study compared the economic benefits of the two on the international market. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
Some things can only be produced in very specific regions.
Certain products are inextricably linked to their geographical locations. It started in France at the beginning of the 20th century when they started protecting wines.
That's Sarah Bowen, assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Bowen studied two products defined by geography, both successful on the market, but with different outcomes for farmers. Comté cheese from France and tequila from Mexico.
Comté has been very successful in terms of stimulating rural development, contributing to jobs in the area, contributing to higher prices for the farm products.
The French farmers regulate all aspects of their industry, exactly what raw materials can be used, what cows can eat, how the cheese is made and exported. But in Mexico, agave farmers who produce the raw materials for tequila don't have the same protections.
Tequila is becoming more and more industrialized, and the smaller tequila companies and the agave farmers are getting pushed out of the supply chain.
A rose petal margarita, please.
Okay.
With salt.
This Philadelphia restaurant called Tequila's serves 125 different kinds of the liquor. But owner David Sura won't serve any blended tequilas.
I don't think that we should call that spirit tequila.
He says blended tequilas are made by multinational companies that use less agave sugars in favor of cheaper ones. That means less money for agave farmers. Suro says Mexico can't control the standards for tequila because so much is produced outside the country.
There is absolutely no way to monitor all the bottling companies outside of Mexico.
Sarah Bowen says governments need to regulate how and where products like tequila are produced in order to protect small farmers.
It's really important for the government to sort of conceive of these regulations not just as trade protection, but as a rural development policy.
Mexican agave farmers need some help. Bowen says the market price for agave is below the cost of production, so farmers are letting their crops rot. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And finally, I don't know about you, Steve, but when I was a kid, I ate Wonder Bread.
Oh, yeah. It was so squishy with peanut butter. Me too. Oh,
The whole cul-de-sac ate Wonder Bread. We all did, man. It was soft, it was non-nutritive, and it was white.
Well, you know, Bill, the Chicago Tribune reports for the first time ever, packaged wheat bread has outsold white bread $2.6 billion a year to $2.5 billion.
Yes, so we now know the greatest thing since sliced bread is stone ground wheat flour, brown sugar, and sunflower seed kernels.
And don't forget rolled oats.
Yes, and flax.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.